Indeed, it's a delight to be with you people again. I don't know, this is maybe my third time or so to be with you. And I don't know what you noticed or not, but Tom has lost some of the buttons off of his jacket. So if you see those, you know who they belong to. All right. I'd like to ask a question or two. Number one, do you know when World War II started? Anyone? 1939, September 1939, when Germany invaded Poland. Do you know when the U.S. entered into the war? Same gentleman again? Who? 1941 at Pearl Harbor. My story goes back nearly that far, right at the end of World War II. And just looking over the congregation, I surmise that I'm the old man of the group. Anyone older than 84? No? I thought not. Before I begin today, let me just read something that I have in my book, and it somewhat kind of brings in a nutshell my life then and even now as I look on the past. This was dedicated to my shipmates. Life is filled with gale force winds that cause the waves to roar, and like the men of Galilee, we strain against the oar. With billows high, we cry aloud, "O Lord, where have you gone?" Then he whispers through the squall, "I've been here all along." O we of little faith, why doubt? Why give our hearts to fear? For when the tempest trials blow, 'tis then we must draw near. For in the winds of every storm, a sovereign eye doth see the waning faith and broken hearts of those like you and me. And with his outstretched hands of love, he reaches down to save all who trust in him alone. For us, his life he gave. So when the tumult o'er us roll, let's thank him for the gale. For in his love, he caused the storm. 'Twas he who set the sail. My story goes back to the end of World War II. As an 18-year-old boy in 1943, I volunteered for the Marine Corps. Went to San Diego for boot camp, and then they said, we want you to go to sea school. I had the foggiest idea of what that might entail, but I soon found out. After some sea schooling, they said, you'll go aboard a large combatant ship. I went to San Francisco, and there sat the big USS Indianapolis. And you could imagine what a country boy from Kentucky thought when he saw something of that magnitude. Those big 8-inch guns, 5-inch guns, 40-millimeter, 20-millimeter, etc. And I say in my book, the largest gun I ever saw was a 12-gauge shotgun. But here I see that. And then, soon after I went aboard, of course, the war was going on strong in the Pacific. I was at Saipan, at Tinian, at Guam, at Sea Battle of the Philippine Sea. I was down at Palau, at Iwo Jima, at Okinawa, 3-hour strikes on Tokyo. And lastly, I was a Marine guard that guarded Fat Man and Little Boy, the components of the two atomic bombs that we were to deliver to our B-29 base on the island of Tinian, and we made a record speed run those next 10 days, those 5,400 miles, to deliver those components to our B-29 base. I recall the morning that they were loaded aboard. We had just been back from Okinawa. We had received a kamikaze plane there. We lost several boys, but we had to come back to the States for repair, and soon after repair, we noticed on the dock a lot of so-called brass, Marine Corps, Navy, And we noticed that it was a large container coming aboard. When I say large, 15 feet long, 5 feet high, 5 feet wide, and they brought that aboard and they put it in the port hangar deck. And my Marine captain said, Harold, I want you to station a guard here and around that that box. Well, Captain, what do we have? He said, we have the foggiest idea. What do you mean? He said, the skipper of the ship doesn't know what we have. But we understand that it's something that every day that we delay in getting it to the forward area will cost lives. Well, that tells you something, doesn't it? And then there were a couple of proposed Air Force men coming aboard, and they had a little crate in a box or in another crate, and we wondered, what in the world? Who are they? What do they have? And a couple of sailors put a rod through that, put it on their shoulders. They took it forward to a compartment there with those officers, and may I say that that was half of all of the uranium that America owned and that anyone owned at that time. And again, my captain said to station a guard on the outside of the hatch of that compartment. Now, may I say that those two Air Force men were not Air Force men. They were scientists from Los Alamos. They had not, at that moment, they had not designated the White Sand Desert atomic bomb. We didn't know whether or not it would even work or not. We made a record speed run to our B-29 base and unloaded our cargo. And then we backed up just a little bit to Guam. And there at CINPAC, the Central Pacific Command, we received our sailing orders. And the sailing orders were to go to the Philippines for the main invasion of Japan. Captain McVeigh asked for an escort. And they tell him, you don't need an escort. Don't need an escort. 1,100 miles across the enemy waters. No, don't need an escort. Well, may I say, they were lying to us. They could have said, you need an escort because 4 days ago we lost a destroyer. We lost 129 boys. They could have said, you need an escort because we have broken the Japanese code. We know everything that they're doing. We don't want them to know that we know, but we know what they're doing. But nevertheless, I said, you don't need an escort. Well, they allowed us to traverse those waters unescorted. No underwater sound gear, and yet there were destroyers that could have escorted us, but you don't need an escort. It was 3 days out of Guam on July the 30th, the night of July 30, 1945, just after midnight. I had gotten off a watch at 12 o'clock, and I went below deck to the Marine compartment, and I got my blanket. I needed a blanket then. I didn't think I needed a Kapok life jacket, so I didn't take my Kapok life jacket. I left it locked up in my locker because supposedly we were in friendly waters and we were traveling, so to speak, wide open, and that all the hatches were wide open. No air conditioning, and so we needed all the air coming in that big steel ship. And so everything was wide open. It was on the night of July 30, just after midnight. I got off a watch, and I went down and got my blanket. I went topside. I go nearly all the way forward. I go up to the forward number, what we call number one turret, a big 8-inch gun, three big guns. And the night before, I'd slept in a raft up on the top of that. But that was kind of a no-no, even though we have a good skipper and even though he permits us to come topside to sleep. I decided that maybe this particular night, I'm going to sleep down on the deck. So I told my buddy Munson, I said, I'm going to sleep down on the deck here. So I took off my shoes, and I used somewhat my shoe as a pillow. I wrapped up with my blanket, and I had just begun to doze off to sleep, and all of a sudden a massive explosion. And when I say massive, you could imagine one being enough that it would just completely obliterate this whole building. The bow of the ship was cut off. The first torpedo cut through about 45 feet of the bow of the ship, and when I say cut it off, it wasn't there. And the next torpedo then was aft me, close to the Marine compartment, and then there was a third explosion, and it was the magazine under number two turret. It exploded and went through the top of the turret. May I say that I was sleeping between the two torpedoes, open deck, wrapped up in my blanket and did not get burnt severely at all, whereas most everyone that were in the open got flash burn, and even if you were on the inside. As I began to take inventory as to really what's happened here, I could look farther to me, and if you could visualize that long, sleek bow, and about 45 feet of that is cut off. And the ship now is moving forward at about 15 miles an hour, 17 knots or so. And you can imagine all of that water now is breaking in, coming in, because we're traveling wide open. And I began to take inventory. What's happened? It has to have been a torpedo. And I realized that I'm supposed to go to the quarterdeck, back midship, to receive orders as to what I'm to be doing. And as I make my way back, there were those in the forward area up on the main deck there, officers' quarters primarily, and here they were coming out. And mind you, it's right after midnight, so they're in their night clothing, very little clothing, and as they came out pleading for help, and that you could see the flesh was hanging from their face and from their arms, and yet that's not my responsibility. I'm making my way to the quarterdeck. And when I get to the quarterdeck, realizing my life jacket is down in the marine compartment, and there's no way that I can go down there. And when I get to the quarterdeck, I see all those canvas bags of life jackets hanging up, and I ask my marine lieutenant's permission to cut some of those down. He said, not until we get word to abandon ship. The ship is sinking. The forward part of the ship, even by now, before I could leave the forward area, the bow of the ship was already under. And even when I'm asking for a life jacket, the starboard side of the ship is listing to so much that there is water on the quarterdeck. And yet you don't cut those life jackets down. And suddenly there was a commander that came from below deck. I could recognize, barely could recognize who he was, because there again, he was flash burned. And as he came topside, some sailor said, get the commander a life jacket. And so they began to cut those down, and I managed to get me a life jacket. And I put it on, and if you know what a Kapok life jacket is, I call it a horse collar. It's a big roll of Kapok, a vest. And I put that on, but I did not fasten it in the straddle, because I knew that momentarily I'm going to be leaving the ship. By now, water is on the quarterdeck, and it is listening to the starboard so much that you can hardly even stand up on the deck. And then suddenly then the word came. Now, mind you that all PA system is out, no communication of any kind. So we're waiting for the captain to maybe pass some word down to abandon ship. And so finally word is coming to abandon ship. And you can imagine the chaos that's taking place there on the quarterdeck when there was probably 100 men there, and they begin to make their way then to the port side, and there's a big steel cable rail there, and they made their way hurriedly to that, and many of them were jumping off, jumping on each other. And I recall scared to death, and as I went over and got a hold of that rail, and as I looked out into the blackness of the night, as I, in my mind, I'm looking out into eternity. This is the end of it. This is the end of life. And may I say, there's times when you pray, and there's times when you pray, and there is a difference. You see, on the 1st of August, 1943, I had already been sworn into the Marine Corps. They sent me home for a few days. As an 18-year-old boy, I had never trusted Christ as my Savior. I went to church, went to Sunday school and church every time the doors were open. I even had made my way forward many times in invitations, but I did not know the Lord Jesus. But after I had officially was a Marine and yet had not shown up even to boot camp, there that Lord's Day morning, as I went to church, seeming the Lord was saying to me, your last chance, your last chance. And I sat there through the whole service. The pastor preached a message. He gave an invitation. He pronounced the benediction, and I sat there. And he came back, and he sat down by me. Already had talked to me different times before. He knew my spiritual condition, and he asked if he could assist, could help. And I said, well, I think today is my last opportunity. I feel that the Holy Spirit is speaking to me. And he turns to a familiar scripture, which is Acts 16:31, which simply says, believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, and thou shalt be saved. And he said, Ed, do you believe that? I said, yes, I believe that. I had believed that even as a youngster in Sunday school. But I had never confessed my sins to the Lord Jesus and looked to what he did for me on the cross of Calvary to pay my sin debt, as we talked about here earlier in the communion. So there that Lord's Day morning, in a few moments' time there, I gave my heart and life to Jesus Christ as my own personal Savior. So now that I'm ready to abandon ship and I look out into the blackness of the night, look out at all that oil on the top of the water, and others had already gone off, and the ship now is sinking. I stepped over the rail. If you could visualize that this is the deck and this is the keel of the ship, I stepped over the rail and made two big long steps down, and I jumped in feet first. My Kevlar jacket came up over my head, and I knew somehow, some way, I've got to get my head above that oil. And then I began to swim away from the ship then. I got away from the ship maybe 50 yards or so, and there are others waiting out there. And we turn and we watch the ship now as she begins to roll. The bow of the ship goes under. And then that fantail comes high in the air. And boys are making their way even to the fantail. Any place that they can get topside to get off. And we're jumping off and jump into those four big screws that are still turning. It took about 12 minutes for the ship to go under. There were 1,197 of us aboard. We surmised that about 900 maybe got off the ship, which meant about 300 did not even come topside. I joined the little group out there watching the ship as she sank. And then we took inventory. There were three of we Marines in the group. There were about 80 of us in total. One Marine buddy had been blown against a bulkhead. He had multiple breaks in his body, and he did not last even till morning. The other Marine had gone into the water head first, and if you could imagine going into a half an inch or so of that oil and getting that in his face, in his eyes, and then there you are in that 110-degree sun weather. All that salt, all the chemicals, all that oil, and him trying to clean some of that out, and more that he tried to clean out, and then that salt then in the water then drying, so he's just grinding powder in his eyes. And even by the third day, Spooner couldn't open his eyes, couldn't close his eyes, could barely see. All right. The first day, we had company. When I say we had company, there were sharks around us all the time. And you could imagine looking out and hear a big fin swimming around the group, around and around and around, seemingly daring someone to come out. And if you can visualize and just think with me just a moment, with 300 or so boys that were aboard the ship, and much of that in the explosion, you can imagine the body parts now that just come topside around the ship. And many of us also that were wounded, that is to the extent that there was blood also from many of we that had even gotten off the ship. So this is attracting the sharks, and they were there. Many, many have said over the years that sharks do not attack live bodies. I'll tell you about it. The first day, we lost several boys. The second day, many, many more. Even by the second day, half of our 80 was gone. By the third day at noon, there are 17 of us. And sharks, to see them come and take a buddy 8 feet from you and take him under and tell me I don't see that, and to see a fin coming directly towards you, and you know that the next moment is the life is over, and yet he goes under you and the dorsal fin hits your feet as he goes under. And you're spared. That has taken place much. Every day. I recall sometime the third day, my buddy Spooner, that had gone into the water head first. He told me that the second day, he told me he was going to commit suicide. I said, Spooner, you're not going to do any such thing. He said, Harold, we know that no word got off of the ship. Well, it did, but we didn't know it at that time. He said, no word has gotten off, and he was in misery. I know he was in misery. And I said, Spooner, you're not going to do any such thing. And I believed that he actually was going to do it. So finally, I asked him, I said, how are you going to commit suicide? He said, I'm just going to take off my life jacket and I'm going to swim down so far that I'll drown before I come back up. I said, you're not going to do any such thing. I grabbed the hold of Spooner. I turned his back to me. I took his Kapok life jacket. I fastened it onto mine, and we swam together through the night. The next morning, he wanted me to release him. I said, Spooner, I'll not release you unless you make a vow to me that you're going to hang with me. When every sailor is gone, there's going to be two Marines that are going to survive this, and you're going to be one of them. And he made me that vow, made me that promise, and I released him. It was sometime even the third day when there's only 17 of us. Well, let me back up to the second day. The second day when we were so desperate for water, and yet we're swimming in it, but our mouth is so dry, so parched. By now, our tongues are swelling in our mouth. Now, normally you can survive 2 or 3 days without water. But if you can visualize 100-plus degree weather, that sun beaming down, we're bareheaded, we're out in the water, we're swimming most of the time, you get thirsty. And by even the second day, our tongues are beginning to swell in our mouth. I was speaking not long ago to a congregation, to a church, and it was an older gentleman back in the back, and at my age, and after it was over, he came forward, and when he got close to me, he said, Marine, I know what it is to have your tongue swell in your mouth. He said, I was in the Bataan Death March, and we just embraced each other, didn't have to say anything, but tears rolled down our cheeks. It was sometime then, the third day at noon, there were only 17 of us. Now, all of them weren't eaten by sharks. But I saw boys that would take some of their clothing and hold it, and someone would put some water up in that, and they'd put their head under it, and they'd drink a little of the salt water. And you can imagine what salt water in a dehydrated body, let me tell you what it'll do. In about 30 minutes' time, you begin to see what's taking place. And you begin to see a buddy just a few minutes ago was coherent. And then all of a sudden, a root beer float substance seemingly would be coming out of his nostrils. And now he's gone. He can imagine that there's an oasis out there, that the ship is out there, that the scuttlebutt in the ship has opened up. Or one guy came up to me and he said, hey, Marine, said, see that island out there? And he could see it in his mind. He said, Captain Parks, Lieutenant Stauffer, and he mentioned several of the Marines are out there. They're having a picnic. They want you to come. I knew better, but yet he was so convincing. And I'm sure that I looked to see, be sure that it wasn't an island out there. And then as he leaves, he goes 25 yards or so away from the group. Then all of a sudden I hear a blood-curdling scream, and I see that Kapok jacket go under, and then like a fish cork, momentarily it comes back up. And you can imagine then all the sharks in it that are going to come around that blood. It was sometime likewise this third day. You know, I was at a college this week, and one of the predominant questions that was asked in the question and answer was, what were you thinking when you were hit? What were you thinking? What were your thoughts when you actually went into the water? And so on. Many questions like that. But what was I thinking, you know, at this particular time when you see that you've been out there this period of time and your group has gone from 80 down to 17? There's no atheists in foxholes. There were no atheists out there. Everyone would pray somehow, some way. It might be, God, if you're out there, we need help. I don't want to die. This one guy said, I've got a son back home I've never seen. And then there were others of us that knew to whom we were praying. The Lord that I had trusted on the 1st of August in 43, and here it is, by now it's August the 2nd, but 3 years later. And I'm praying. And we're praying for water. We're praying for help. Our Kapok life jackets, even by now, will not hold our heads out of the water. And we're swimming. But I take off my Kapok jacket and I turn it bottom side up and I'm sitting in it. And it has enough buoyancy that I'm keeping my head above water, but I'm moving, I'm swimming, I'm working all the time in the hot sun. And then to have the Lord to answer prayer. Came up on a swell, look off at a distance, and here appeared to be a little makeshift of a raft. And we yelled out at them, and they at us in English, and we knew that it was some of our buddies. And finally they made their way into our group. And when they came into our group, then let me tell you what I saw. No one was on the raft. There were five sailors around the raft. But what was on it was a lifesaver. It's what I desperately needed. I needed a new life jacket. And here, as they came into our group, here they had taken life jackets off of boards that had already expired, and they'd squeezed them out the best that they could, and they put them up on top of that little raft. And now in that 100-degree sun, they're drying out a little bit. And they said, we're swimming to the Philippines. Well, they didn't know it was another 500 miles. But we see planes flying over every day, but no one's looking for us. They're up at 30,000 feet, and no doubt our B-29's bombing Japan. But no one's looking for us. They wanted someone to join with them. And I look at my buddy Spooner, and I said, Spooner, I'm going to go with them. And when you see a group of 80 go down to 17, it's time to do something, isn't it? Go west, young man, go west. And I said, I'm going to go with him. And Spooner said, Harold, if you go, I'm going to go. So here two Marines joined five sailors, and we started out to the Philippines. Well, the others that we're leaving behind, they said, you know, you're foolish, but anyway, here we plug along. Sometime late in the afternoon there of that third day when we're completely exhausted. And it's hardly enough mind to even know what we're even trying to do. And we came up on the swell, and I could look off at the starboard at a distance, and all of a sudden I thought, I see an old crate or something out there. And here we are in 10 or 12 foot swells, and you know, when we're up, you don't see anything but sky and water. And finally, it's up when we're up again, and I pointed it out to my buddies, and I said, there's an old crate out there. I'm going to swim out and get it. Well, you're foolish, you know, to swim out after an old crate out there. And I said, it could be water, it could be food, there's something. I'm going to swim out and get it. I have my heavy Kapok jacket waterlogged on, and I dog paddle out there. And I said, get closer and closer. You know, I'm praying. I need water. I need food. There's no way that I'm going to make it without it. And then when I get close to that crate, you know, I didn't pause and say, thank you, Lord, for what I'm about to partake of. I saw those potatoes there floating in the top of the water there in that crate. And in desperation, I'm making my way. I'm thanking the Lord, yes, for what I'm about to receive. And then kind of in the agony of defeat, as I got a hold of that first potato, as that rot began to squeeze through my fingers, I thought, rotten potatoes, rotten potatoes. You ladies, you know what rotten potatoes smell like. I know what they taste like. And to take that potato and somewhat peel it with your hands and with your mouth, you don't spit out all the rot. You're desperate for water. You're desperate for food. I begin to fill my dungaree pockets in with half-rotten potatoes. And then I'm swimming back into my buddies with an arm up on that crate with still more half-rotten potatoes in there. And nibbling, no doubt, on one, and I'm making my way, and they holler out at me, what is it? Rotten potatoes! But they joined me, and we had a picnic. All we had to eat was half-rotten potatoes, but may I say they were godsend. And then we thought that when nighttime came that we'd be able to see, you know, the moon when it went down, or the sun when it went down, the moon when it came up. We'd be able to see the Southern Cross. We'd know which way was west, which way is the Philippines. It's 500 miles or so long. And if we can get a little closer, surely someone will spot us. Well, by nighttime, we could see. We don't even know where the sun is. We couldn't see the sun. And so nighttime comes, and it's dark. When I say dark, it was as dark as it was the night that we were hit. So what do? We're just hanging on to a raft. And then we hear voices. And after a period of time, we could yell at them and they at us in English, and we knew it was some of our buddies. And then after a period of time, about 1 o'clock or so that night, here a Navy lieutenant, Charles McKissick from Texas, here he's leading a group of boys, and they're swimming to the Philippines, actually swimming. And as he came into our group, I think there may have been 6 boys with him, 5 or 6 or so boys with him. But they would come in, you know, a minute apart or several seconds apart before they would come in. And then it's so dark we can't see. Are you one of the new ones, or are you one of the, you know, my buddies that had been with me? And then they tell us that they're swimming to the Philippines. We tell them that's what we're trying to do. And I know McKissick said, you're not going to take that raft, would you? That'll hold you back. And we knew that if we could get close enough that, you know, someone no doubt would see us. But then there was a certain Marine that had a pocket full of potatoes. He began to share those with McKissick and the others. And may I say, I don't know what happened the rest of the night, really. I do not know what happened the rest of the night. I know that the next morning, I'm not with my buddy Spooner. I'm not with the raft. I'm not with those other 5 sailors. I'm with 1 other sailor and McKissick, the 3 of us. And by now, my life jacket still won't hold me out of the water. In other words, even though it had some water squeezed out of it and it did good for a time, but even by now, here on this 4th day, my life jacket, I've taken it off. I'm sitting at it, and I'm having to keep doing this. It had enough buoyancy that it would pitch me if I ceased swimming. And then I look over at the sailor here. You can imagine, you know, we're on one side of the swell and the other. We're 50 yards apart. We get back together. And then I look at this sailor, and I see that his head is seemingly dropped into the water. I go over, and I shake him, and he responds. He's still alive, but no conversation at all with him. A little bit later, I check him again, and his head likewise is, he's giving up. His head is in the water. And maybe the 3rd time I checked him, he was gone. So it's McKissick and myself. And McKissick would say to me, hey, Marine, have you ever been to the Philippines? No, I've never been there. Well, he had, and he was going to take me under wing, you know, once we got there, as if we were going to make it. And well, sometime then later that afternoon, we heard a plane. And when I say a plane, now we could see them every day at 30,000 feet, see that trail behind them. But we could hear a plane. And I think I responded to him about as soon as he did to me. We hear a plane! We hear a plane! And you can imagine our physical condition, but yet there was renewed vim, vigor, and vitality. You know, all of a sudden, we see a plane. Here it's going to fly directly over us. He's going to be flying up about 8,000 feet. And here we splash water, we yell, we do everything imaginable, you know, to attract his attention. But may I say, if you had Deer Hunter Orange on and he knew you were down there, impossible for him to see us. In fact, I talked to the pilot many times since then, but he said, Harold, it would be the equivalent of taking a human hair. Look at the end section of a human hair at 20 feet. That would be the possibility of me seeing you down there. But in the providence of God, may I say, he saw us. Here, McKissick and I, we're waving, we're hollering. And when he gets, I could surmise a quarter of a mile out, all of a sudden, here he starts down. As if he knew we were there. But he didn't know. Let me tell you the story. Lieutenant Gwynn, Chuck Gwynn, was flying a Venturio. I call it a B-25. Anyway, it's a land-based plane flying out of Palau looking for submarines. And as he left Palau that morning, or a little before then, he was having trouble with his radio antenna. That little trailer that trails behind that aircraft, the stabilizer on that had come off. And so you can imagine that's just whipping back and forth. And momentarily, he turns the controls over to his co-pilot. He goes aft, he opens the hatch there, And he reels in that antenna, and he's going to put something on it to stabilize it so his radio message will get out. And as he's looking through that porthole, you know what he saw? He didn't see us. But he saw the oil that was on our clothing. Just like the little mirror for you Boy Scouts. He saw the oil down there. He rushed back to take over the controls, and those of his crew said, "So what is it?" They knew that he saw something. And he said, "Look down there." And they began to look down there, and they saw likewise the oil slick. Now, may I say that even though there were only the two of us, you know, there were bodies strewn all over. 75 miles of bodies. And still other survivors. And he comes down, and you know what he was doing? He was doing this as he went around us. And we knew that he saw us. Now, he didn't know who we were, had the foggiest idea who we were. But as he circled us two or three times, and I can nearly see his face now. They were that close as they went around us several times. And then he goes back up, and I wonder, well, what's he going back up there for? He went up to where he could reach out with his radio, and he declared, "Ducks on the pond." They know whose ducks we were. But then that message reaches Palou and Adrian Marks, another Navy pilot who pilots a PBY, was already fueled up, gassed up, ready to go out on a search and destroy, and he gets the message, and here he leaves in a hurry. And an hour or two or so later, here he arrives on the scene. And as he arrives on the scene, he sees bodies. He sees as many sharks as he sees bodies, at least live bodies. He saw a group of about 30 men, and he said that there were more than 30 sharks attacking those boys at the time. He radios back base, permission to land. Well, you don't land a PBY in open sea. But permission was not granted. But after he sees the boys being devoured by sharks, he and his crew said, "We're going to land." And he notifies back, "We are landing." And he shuts off his radio and he lands. And that plane, I didn't see this, but they said that the plane, when it actually came down, if you could imagine a 10-foot swell of water, and him hitting that, and he bounced up in the air, they said 50 feet or so, and finally set it down. And then the pontoon is ripped quite a bit. One motor is knocked out. And later then I realized that he was picking up boys, but on behind us someplace, somewhere. And then finally he picked up McKissick, and I was in hopes that that he would tell him that there was a Marine out there with him. It took some time. Well, in the meantime, the B-25 had dropped the life raft for McKissick and myself. But McKissick had made his way to that, and he had already left because, for some reason or other, I didn't know why he was leaving it, but he was going to the plane now that has landed. And when I made my way to that little life raft, its bottom upside down, the CO2 on it was torn off, so it wouldn't hold anyone. Big hole in it, no water on it, and so I'm spending too much time there rather than to making my way then to where the plane had landed. After a period of time, then that big wing comes over me, and they pitched out a little ring, and they picked me up. McKissick was aboard, and after I got aboard, there were 56 of us aboard that plane. The plane won't hold 56. There were 7 of them tied out on the wings. And when I got aboard, it was like a sack of feed. They drug me in, and I couldn't stand up, couldn't hardly even sit up. But they would take me like a sack of feed, and they'd stack this guy here, the next boy, stack him here. And by the way, when the plane was picking me up, if you could visualize, you've got a big swell here, and the cap of this is about 25 to 30 feet from the cap of the other. And the plane now cannot go against that. If those props would hit going directly into that, it flipped the plane. So Lieutenant Gwynn was following the could we say, the trough to where he could turn and go back. And I thought he was never going to make it to me. I could hear him here and hear him there, and finally he comes over me, and that big wing goes out over me, and hurriedly they threw out the ring. They drug me up close enough, and some little sailor, and I think he weighed 400 pounds. I think he was 9 feet tall. But anyway, somehow he pulled me out of the water, and I believe that he even pulled me over his shoulder and pulled me back in the plane. Now, he had to do that in a hurry. The plane could not stop. The plane is still moving. I get aboard the plane. They stack me here. And after a little bit, I look across the plane. I saw USMC. I saw that blonde hair with all that oil in his face and his eyes. That's Spooner. You know what Spooner was doing? He had a can of green beans, and he was feeling down on the deck of that aircraft, and he finally found a little stud bolt or something there. He had that can of green beans. He was knocking a hole in that can of green beans, and finally he had a hole in it, and he turned it up and was drinking that bean juice. And I said, Spooner, how about some of your bean juice? Well, may I say, you'd have to know Spooner. But he kindly told me where I could get off. And I said, Spooner, you don't know who this is. I happen to be his squad leader. And may I just say, in respect to him, he had been shanghaied out of three different outfits when he came aboard our ship. And Captain Park said, Harold, your squad is one man short, so you inherit Spooner. And here's the history. And do not allow him to bring reproach on the Marine Corps aboard this ship. He said, I don't care what you have to do to him. I don't care if you have to throw him overboard, and you'd have to know Captain Parks. And he meant what he said. And so Spooner and I had made friends early on. So Spooner kind of fell across there, the aircraft, with his bean juice. And then they picked up, as I mentioned, they picked up 56 of us. And sometime later that night, then the USS Doyle, a destroyer, began to come in. That was the first ship that came in for rescue. And as it came in that night, I'm aboard the plane. The plane can't take off. The pontoon is ruptured. One motor is ruptured. But they were able to bail water and so on so that we could at least stay afloat. And then the Doyle, the destroyer, came in sometime that night. And Commander Clater, the captain of the ship, he turned on all of his big lights underneath the clouds. And if you could imagine a mushroom with lights shining up under the bottom of a mushroom, that's what we were seeing. And for all the other boys that are going to have to stay out there the rest of another night, that was at least hope. And so as he came into the group, then I was transferred aboard the aircraft, aboard the Doyle, and was taken into Palau. The next day they were picking up many, many, many other boys. There were 317 of the 1197, in other words, 880 that did not make it. I was taken to Palau. I was in a hospital there, a makeshift of a hospital, for a couple of days, and they caught the USS Tranquility, a Red Cross ship, hospital ship, that brought me to Guam. I was in the hospital in Guam for, a week or two or more. And then finally we caught an aircraft carrier that brought us back to the States. I got back to the States on October the 2nd. Now, I had a 30-day survivor leave, 30-day rehabilitation leave, and after we got rid of the components of the bomb at Saipan, or at Tinian, we 3 days before we encountered Commander Hoshimoto, I made sergeant, and it didn't get off the ship. So a Marine sergeant that made it said, Harold, if you'll stay in, I'll see to it that you get, you know, that sergeant's rating. Well, that meant something to me. And I had agreed that, yeah, I'm going to stay in then. I want that sergeant's rating, that extra $20 a month or whatever, you know, that they would be paying me. Anyway, but I didn't get that far. Because when I got to the States, on the 3rd of October that night, I had a hurting in my side. I mean a hurting in my side. And I endured till the morning, and then the sergeant that was in charge of him, I told him I wanted to, I got to go to sick bay. Well, he wanted to get an ambulance. I said, no, I know where sick bay is. I went through boot camp here and C school here. And so anyway, I made my way to sick bay. Within the hour, I'm aboard an ambulance taking me to Balboa Hospital in San Diego. I have a perforated appendix. And when I got there, my blood count and all was of such that they knew that they couldn't operate. It was 29 days later, after 11,800,000 units of penicillin, that they finally operated on me. I stayed in the hospital in San Diego then through Thanksgiving, through Christmas, through New Year's, and sometime in January. Then they sent me back to the Marine Corps base, and I ended up in Great Lakes Naval Station, I think on the 16th of February 1946, and asked permission to be relieved of my Marine Corps duty. I think in closing, I'd like to just read you something that kind of tells the story likewise. The possibility of us being spotted there in the water. The guy that actually picked me up, Adrian Marks, talking about the possibility of our being spotted out there, he says this: what were the chances that Wilbur Gwynn would fly a course which would take him directly over you? And what were the chances that his radio antenna would break while he was out on this mission? What were the chances that he would open his bomb bay doors and look straight down momentarily? And what were the chances that he would look straight down on one of you? You didn't have a chance in a million. I know that most of you prayed a lot, and I know that some of you feel that it made a difference. Wilbur Gwynn is a wonderful man and a fine pilot. He never said that he heard a voice speak to him, but was there an unseen voice upon his shoulder? Did he find you by pure chance? The odds against it are one in a million, nay, one in a billion. But somehow he was chosen as the instrument to overcome these impossible astronomical odds. Wilbur Gwynn looked down at the split second that would become one of the great moments of history. I, as well as you, am proud to know him as a friend. Any sensible person knows that no one can swim for 4.5 days, and yet you did. For 40 years, I have reflected upon the blind courage and the unbelievable greatness of spirit that I saw when each survivor was brought aboard my airplane. And I have been compelled by the evidence of my own eyes to believe in miracles. May I say that I believe in the providence of God. So many, many things that happened to me out there those 4.5 days that I know that a sovereign God was with me and was giving me directions and brought me through such an ordeal. And I travel all over the country now that my son insists that our story be told. And after 9/11, he said, "Dad, we've got to write your story." So in 2005, we wrote the book, Out of the Depths. And after we had written it, I wondered, you know, who do I get to do the foreword for me? And I told David, I said, you know, last night I was thinking, why don't we call Oliver North and see if he would do the foreword for our book? And he said, well, I know someone that knows someone that knows his email address. So we got his email address, and I sent him an email, or David did. He responded and said, send me the guts of the book. We sent him the guts of the book, and then the next day or two, at home, the phone rang, and I picked up the phone. I just said, hello. And he said, is this Edgar? And I said, yes, it is. And I knew it was Oliver North. And he said, I would be honored to do the foreword to your book. He did that. And then I knew that we were having our reunion in Indianapolis within the month after that. And I said, why don't you come to Indianapolis for our reunion? We'll have 2,500 people or so there. And he responded by saying that he was somewhat employed with Fox News, but he had a certain amount of liberty. And On that particular day, he was to be, the next day on Saturday, he was to be in Milwaukee. And he said, I could come by on Friday evening. So on Friday evening, he was with us in Indianapolis, and I managed to have him there to speak to us that night. Well, there's a lot of things that I could talk about and tell you. But anyway, it's been my privilege since my book came out. I've been in 24 states now. I was at a college in Virginia just this week, and a college in Virginia likewise, I think 3 weeks before that. And I'm someplace every week or two, basically telling what you heard today. There's a lot more that I don't think of. Sometimes I can get off on a rabbit trail, and so I try to just give you the pertinent information. But it's a delight to be with you today, and I appreciate your patience to hear me, some of you, maybe the third time. So, Tom, it's an honor to be here with your people today, and I thank you so kindly.